from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's Friday night, and we're talking about the Thornton Wilder classic play, now back on Broadway, Our Town.
The name of our town is Drover's Corners, New Hampshire. It's just across the line from Massachusetts. Latitude is 42 degrees, 40 minutes. Longitude is 70 degrees, 37 minutes. Running right through the middle of the town is Main Street. Cutting across Main Street on the left is the railroad tracks. Beyond the railroad tracks is Polish Town. You know, foreign folks who come here to work in the mills, a couple of Canuck families and the Catholic Church. You can see the steeple of the Congregational Church. The Presbyterian is just across the street. The Methodist and the Unitarian are up a block. The Baptist Church is down in the hollow by the river. Next to the post office is the town hall. Jails in the basement. Brian once made a speech right from those very steps. It's a nice town, you know what I mean?
Somewhere at the intersection of life and death, of ordinary daily routines and eternity, lies Thornton Wilder's Grover's Corners, New Hampshire. This is Our Town, the archetypal small town ambling along in the innocent air of American life before World War I. Since Wilder's play was first performed to poor reviews in 1938, Our Town has become one of America's most enduring and beloved stage classics. In high school drama classes, for summer stock companies, and now with Paul Newman back on Broadway, Our Town has become one of the most staged theatrical works of the 20th century. At the dawn of a new century, we're looking at how this Depression-era classic still speaks to us today. Tonight, we'll be joined by Jackson Breyer, professor of English at the University of Maryland and editor of Conversation with Thornton Wilder, by Liz Diamond, the chair of the directing program at the Yale School of Drama and the resident director of the Yale Repertory Theater, and by our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. But first, we're joined by Thornton Wilder's nephew and literary executor, Tappan Wilder. Good evening and welcome, Tappan Wilder.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for joining us. We delight again to see Our Town perpetually and always coming back. There it is, up in the big lights on Broadway. Tappan Wilder, give us a sense of where this work emerged in the arc of Thornton Wilder's life and career. What are the wellsprings of this, and at what point did he deliver it?
Well, I guess at the deepest level, you have to go all the way back to a young man who always wrote a dramatic line, even as a child, and loved to tell stories, and even as novelists, his novels are terribly dramatic. And that's what one of his spurs, The Bridge of San Luis Rey in 1927, made him world famous. And by the 30s, he was really turning back to what his first love was, at least in this period, which was drama. And you find the beginnings of Our Town, pieces of it, in one-act plays he was writing and a translation he did, which has been forgotten, where there's a stage manager, for example, even in a movie script that the world doesn't know. He did a Joan of Arc, which deals with sacrificial things. And all this came together by the late 30s with, a passion and interest in telling an archetypal story, and it focuses on the part of the world he knew well, which is New Hampshire, where the McDowell Colony is, where his brother had been a minister, where he'd worked as a child.
The Writers' Colony, of course.
The McDowell Colony, the Writers' Colony in Peterborough, which is associated with it, although the play was largely written in outside Zurich, in a little town outside Zurich in Switzerland. It started in New Hampshire.
Jack Beatty, our man in New Hampshire, what is it about this play, Our Town, that keeps it coming back and back and back, even when the scenes, the voices, the context is very much one of early 20th century Americana?
Well, it sure is. But first, hello to Tappy Wilder. Nice to have you on our program. it keeps coming back because, of course, its beat is the human condition, the stuff that doesn't change. The Tappy says archetypes, and indeed, that's what it is. It's a play of father, son, mother, daughter, birth, childhood, love, marriage, death. All the big moments are there, and the play begins. The first scene in the play is of a doctor coming back from having delivered twins, and the last scene, the last image, is of a young man throwing himself on the grave of his just-deceased wife who died in childbirth.
So the full arc of life is there in many dimensions.
It is. It is. And it's there movingly. You know, there's a kind of matter-of-fact sentimentality about the play. That is the Yankee stage manager who sets up the acts and intervenes in the action. He's got a kind of the very tone in his voice, the twang, seems to work against the sentimentality that's inherent in the material. And he sort of saves it from bathos, I think, and makes it something a little tartar.
Captain Wilder, give us just in a nutshell the story of this play for those who somehow, in all these performances that it's had, have not seen or read it. The story, the arc of Our Town, the stage play.
Well, you've got the first act, which is Our Town, then Love and Marriage, and the third act is Death. So it's the cycle of life. And Thornton picked to tell it. That's the story he told in much of his work, but he picked to tell it in his particularly pure way, if you will, by setting it down into town at the turn of the century. It's really, don't ever quote me on this, please, it's not a story about small-town life in America. It's been, I think there are people who feel it that's way. This is my view, of course.
Uh-huh.
But he's taking advantage in a very calculating, wise way, taking a very simple little setting to tell these stories, and it's become interpreted as a portrait of life in small towns at the turn of the century. And I don't think that's fair to the play, and the professional productions, I think, show that to be clear.
So you're saying this is no little Norman Rockwell setting. It's the whole human condition that just happens to be against small town New Hampshire backdrop?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, I think you have to be very careful here because there is a lot of sentiment in the play, important sentiment, as Jack. There's also sentimentality. I think, Jack, isn't that what you said, sentimentality, Jack?
Yeah.
I think you've got to dissociate those two. The sentiment's very important. I don't know how much down deep sentimentality is. I'm not sure how much is there. In the high school productions, and the kids get a great deal out of doing this play, and it's done, you know, over 350 times, I guess. It's
a year, I suppose.
A year, a year. In high schools alone, you sense that, and that's inevitable, and I think it's important. But the play also has very tough sentiment in it, and there's a marvelous guy named Howard Stein, a great theater educator, who talks about the irony in Our Town. And the toughness of it, which is also there. And professional theater companies can get at that. It's hard for the students, high school students, to see that.
So here's Thornton Wilder's play. It comes into Grover's Corners, New Hampshire.
Yeah.
It breaks it into kind of it comes into the intimate details of life, of a couple of families that live on the same block, and they're up for breakfast, and the repeat and the repeat and the repeat of the milkman delivering the milk, and people going off to work, and
sure.
Folks sitting at their jobs, and this omnipresent stage manager narrator introduces us to different folks along the way. Some of them stand up and give us speeches. There's love and marriage and death, and even great soliloquies from beyond the grave, where characters look back on their life and say, "Why didn't I make more of this?" As I listen to it again, I'm reminded it brings up the Spoon River anthology. It brings up Dylan Thomas's Under Milk Wood somehow in my mind.
Yeah.
What did your uncle Thornton Wilder think of the way it was received in its first round of reception, and then as it grew into this enormous American phenom?
Well, you said there were bad reviews. In fact, the reviews were, you know, very bad in Boston. They weren't. It opened for one night in Princeton, then moved on to Boston, where it closed after a week. I'm sorry for Boston, because I grew up
Boston's
there,
loss.
That's the way it was. And then it was a great success when it opened
yes.
in New York, and it was described as immortal by 1944. I'm not going to answer your question directly because it's a big one, and I'm trying to write a 10-page history of the play using a lot of new material, so I'm buried in it at the moment. But I will say that, you know, what he's doing is trying to pose questions. He doesn't have any answers. And so what did he think about it? I think he was extremely pleased that it did so well. And I'll tell you, he's extremely pleased. And I don't think most Americans understand this and realize the extent to which this is an international play. It's done all over the world. And it's done and has been done all over the world almost from the beginning.
I guess, but the kernel of that question is...
The point of that is, of course, that it is a timeless, and it's not necessarily place specific. You see what what I mean?
As framed in place as it is, we understand exactly what you're saying. And I guess my question is, did he see Americans understanding the large canvas you're telling us that he intended to be seen here, the whole human condition, or did he see this play embraced in the kind of sentimentality that you're resisting as a framework for it?
Well, I think he came to understand that that was one of the appeals of it, and he was very glad that high schools did it, but he was very concerned that it also receive very serious professional productions, because in many ways it's a very different play. Inevitably, it's a different play mm-hmm. when it's done by professional groups.
And formally, it's kind of a daring play, isn't it, Tappy?
In terms of its form.
In
terms of its form.
It's very radical. He wasn't the only one not to use staging going on at that time. That was beginning to happen. But as some important scholarship has shown, what's unique about his use of the stage manager, it's a very radical play, is that the stage manager plays so many different roles. You know, he's an actor sometimes.
Right.
He's a commentator. Sometimes he's moving stuff around the stage.
Weaving right in and out. Are you surprised to see this play back on Broadway in 2002, Tappenwalder?
No, it turns up on Broadway about every 5 or 6 years. In fact, it's been in New York already twice this year, not on Broadway the first time. And there's somebody right now who would like to do it off Broadway early next year. New York is part of its home. It's wonderful to have a major performance like this, which draws attention to it in its first class. I had the pleasure of seeing it. It's really, really a fine performance. And it's very good because it also, of course, draws attention not only to the play but also to the man. There are many other features of Thornton Wilder. My problem as manager, this is not what your show's about. My problem is also to challenge, and this is beginning to happen. People are awfully interested in the other 12 Wilders that exist besides the man who wrote Our Town. Mm-hmm. And this both helps and hurts that.
Well, it's a wonderful problem to have. Tappenwalder, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Tappenwalder is Thornton Wilder's nephew and literary executor, honorary chair of the Thornton Wilder Society.
And now the social and political report. Editor Webb? Charlie Webb's the father of Wally and Emily. Emily's the smart girl with a good memory. You know, you saw her at breakfast. All right, Editor Webb, it's your turn now.
Well, I don't have to tell you that we're run here by a board of select men. All males vote at the age of 21. Women vote indirect. Politically, we're 86% Republican, 12% Democrat, 4% Socialist. Rest indifferent. Religiously, we're 85% Protestants, 12% Catholics. Rest indifferent. Very ordinary town, if you ask me, but our young people here seem to like it well enough.
Now, is there anybody in the audience who'd like to ask Editor Webb any questions about our town?
Is there much drinking in Grover's Corners?
Well, ma'am, I wouldn't know what you'd call much. Saturday nights, the farmhands meet down at Ellery Greenough's stable and holler some. We got one or two town drunks, but they're always having remorses every time an evangelist comes to town. No, I'd say that liquor wasn't a regular thing in the home here, except in the medicine chest. Right good for snake bites, you know, always was.
The character Charles Webb, editor and publisher of the local paper in our town, Thornton Wilder's great classic, and then you see in the challenging form a plant, and the audience asks, is there much drinking in Grover's Corners? Jack Beatty, everything is dry. Editor Webb comes right back, totally unflappable. Well, there's a little hooting and hollering among guys in the barn on Saturday night. That's about it.
Yes, and there's a nice, Tappy said, vein of wit in the play that, again, works against the intrinsically moving, sentiment-charged story. And with the Yankee twang, it's all to the better. But, you know, we were talking a minute ago about how the play seems to belong to the whole world, and Tappy was reminding us of that. And in the play, the daughter of Editor Webb gets a she talks about a postcard that came to a friend of hers. Joan Crawford, the Crawford Farm, Grover's Corners, Sutton County, New Hampshire, United States of America. continent of North America, Western Hemisphere, the Earth, the solar system, the universe, the mind of God, and the postman delivered it.
And too much fun. Jack Beatty, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about Thornton Wilder's stage classic, Our Town, back on Broadway, undying in the American mind. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Thornton Wilder's great stage classic, Our Town.
Well, 3 years have gone by. The sun's come up over 1,000 times. Summers and winters have cracked the mountains a little bit more, and the rain's brought down some of the dirt. Some babies who weren't even born before have begun talking regular sentences already. And some folks who thought they were right young and spry have discovered they can't bound up a flight of stairs the way they used to without their hearts fluttering a little. All that can happen in 1,000 days. Nature's been pushing and contriving in other ways, too. A number of young people fell in love and got married. Most everybody in the world gets married. In this town, there aren't hardly any exceptions. What you've seen was called the daily life. Let's call what you're going to see love and marriage.
Thornton Wilder's Our Town, there's love and marriage, rain and sun, babies and daily life. We're talking about the great stage classic tonight. It's back on Broadway right now with Paul Newman in the stage manager role. What is it about this century-old setting that still speaks in its description of the human condition to us today? We're joined tonight by Jackson Breyer, professor of English at the University of Maryland and editor of Conversations with Thornton Wilder. Good evening and welcome, Jackson Breyer.
Hello, how are you, Tom?
Well, thanks so much for joining us. And from New York City by Liz Diamond, chair of the directing program at the Yale School of Drama and resident director at the Yale Repertory Theater. Welcome, Liz Diamond.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us. Liz Diamond, talk to us first, if you'd be good enough, about the staging of Our Town. Tappan Wilder was saying just a couple of minutes ago about how this was some ambitious stagecraft that Thornton Wilder unfolded in this play. Does it still feel that way today? Can you feel that this was groundbreaking? Was it really groundbreaking in the way he made use of the theatrical space?
It was certainly a use of the stage that few in this country had ever seen before, although certainly Wilder himself harkened back to the French neoclassicists, notably Racine, and to Shakespeare himself, to say nothing of Euripides and the dramatists of ancient Greece for their use of absolutely the naked stage and the enlistment of the audience's imagination to create the story. So I think his antecedents were many, but certainly I think to the extent that he was restoring to the stage the kind of integrity of the stage as a kind of void upon which we would write the text of the visual text of the production was a tonic at the time.
Liz Diamond, paint that picture for us. For anyone who went out and got the video version of the Hollywood version, of course, that's not at all what you see. You see milk jugs and rubbing and horses
actual
and sleighs.
Cows.
Yeah, cows and, washboards and aprons and gravestones and the whole works. But just paint the image. Is this all mimed in the stage production effectively, or how would you describe it?
The Broadway theater goer in 1937 puts on their best bib and tucker, heads uptown to 42nd Street, and walks into a beautiful gilt and velvet theater and sits down. The luscious velvet curtain rises, and what do they behold? A bare stage. Mm-hmm. The radiators along the back wall can be seen. The exit signs.
What's this?
The traps, the fly rail, everything is there, exposed. And, out onto the stage wanders this rather pedestrian-looking gentleman who speaks to them directly. Now, anyone with a bit of a theatrical education at the time would have seen the debt Wilder owed, and I'm sure, deeply acknowledged to Pirandello, but other more contemporary dramatists from Europe in the 20th century. But I think it would have had a visceral shock to a contemporary Broadway audience, which was absolutely used to going in and seeing, you know, everything down to the nail filings out there on stage.
Jackson Brier, what was the contemporary reception of that revolutionary staging when people showed up and the setting wasn't there, but the whole evocation of small town New Hampshire was? How was it received? Was this seen as revolutionary in an American context?
Oh, of course. I mean, Liz is absolutely right. It was a shock. I mean, Our Town is a play that I think over the years has succeeded in spite of itself. I mean, there's everything about it that you would think wouldn't work, and it's probably the most maligned American play in terms of people saying, oh, not that play again, and yet every time it's done well, it works. And Pete Gurney, who is a very, very good contemporary playwright of his own right, said once that what makes Our Town work so well is that as an outsider to the theater, Wilder, although he'd gone to the theater a lot, and as Tappy said, certainly knew a lot about theater, he was essentially a novelist, and he was perhaps more aware than many playwrights of the basic artificiality of the stage and of the fact that he was on a stage. And Our Town is constantly reminding you that you're in a theater watching a play. All of Wilder's plays do that. And so Gurney points out that that's one of the major factors in the play, that there's a tension between drawing attention to the fact that you're on stage and yet attempting to depict something that is really going on.
So does this make Thornton Wilder an early, well, certainly modernist, but deconstructionist, where he's playing with the audience's sense of reality, even as he depicts a 1901, a 1910 New Hampshire town?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there were certainly other playwrights. Liz mentioned Pirandello, mm-hmm. who did exactly the same thing, but I dare say there weren't a lot of people in that audience at the opening night of Our Town that had seen much Pirandello, and you know, mm-hmm. Americans tend to favor their own anyway, so Wilder was immediately embraced as this great innovator when, in fact, he was following in the footsteps, although certainly doing his own variation on something that had been done before and putting an American twist on it. One thing, though, that nobody has said yet, which I'm sure Tappy would agree with and probably I hope Liz would too, is that one of the other major accusations about this play, which is very unfair, is that it presents a kind of Pollyannish, overly optimistic view of life and sort of Norman Rockwell America. Nothing could be further than the truth. You played that excerpt where somebody asks from the audience if there's any drinking in Our Town, mm-hmm. and the editor says no, but one of the major characters in the play is the town drunk, who is also the choir master at the local church, mm-hmm. and who ends up drinking himself to death. And so, and there are lots of other places in the play, including, of course, the famous last graveyard scene, which are very, very dark scenes, and certainly make it clear that Wilder was aware of the darker side of life. And it's a great misaccusation of Wilder in general that he is unaware of those elements. That's one of the things that makes the play so enduring, is that it doesn't just present a happy, sappy, sentimental view. I would argue that it's one of the least sentimental plays that we have in the American major repertory.
Let's listen to just a little bit of that darker side. Here's the famous scene where Emily, the bright young girl who's been married and had birthdays and had children and ultimately dies in childbirth, from the grave goes back to her 16th birthday party and asks why she can't live just for a moment again.
Have time to look at one another. I didn't realize so all that was going on. And we never noticed. Once I go back to my grave, wait. One more look. Goodbye, world. Goodbye, Grover's Corner. Mama, Papa. Goodbye, the clock's ticking. My butternut tree and Mama's sunflower. Food and coffee. New iron dresses and hot baths. And sleeping and waking up. Oh, Earth, you're too wonderful for anybody to... Do any human beings ever realize life while they live it? Every minute.
Character Emily Webb speaking from beyond the veil of death in our town, longing for hot baths and sleeping and waking. Jack Beatty, what is it, as I looked back at this again, we see Emily Webb in this very historic kind of setting, or early setting, early 20th century, feeling that her life had been so rushed and so kind of unconsidered that she's desperate to go back. She wishes she could live it again in a more vivid, aware way. But my gosh, if this life, as portrayed in the early 20th century, was rushed and unmindful, how much more unmindful and rushed are we today? I thought that, you know, what I was seeing portrayed there looked like a fairly... genteel and softly paced life compared to our lives now.
Well, it certainly does. And several points the stage manager remarks about the number of horses versus the number of automobiles. And as the play goes on, by to 1913, the automobiles finally outnumber the horses, but the pace is slower. And there's a crucial piece of dialogue, or actually his monologue, where he's setting up the third act, and he's talking about the what's happening to the people in the graveyard. And he says they're waiting for something they feel is coming, something important and great. Aren't they waiting for the eternal part in them to come out clear? And there's that feeling about all of this play. You know, the people are waiting, mm-hmm. and they're waiting for the eternal part, whatever that might be, to come out clear. The last line of Wilder's novel, The Bridge of St. Louis Ray, sort of sums up, I think, part of the vision in this play. It is, there is a land of the living and a land of the dead, and the bridge is love, the only survival, the only meaning.
Mm, there it is. Liz Diamond, I was struck by that very gap and the bridge over it that Thornton Wilder clearly assumed his audience would be able to make, that he was counting on a sense that the living could sense the land of the dead. Mm-hmm. Do you think that still resonates today? It brings back to my mind the kind of even 19th century sense of closeness to the dead. Does that still resonate with 21st century audiences?
Does closeness to the dead resonate? Is that the question?
Yes.
Well, I tell you what I think resonates with audiences mm-hmm. today. I think reflecting back on your earlier intriguing question about why we keep coming back to this play, I really think, Tom, that we keep coming back to works of art when somehow a full apprehension of them keeps slipping through our fingers. I think that's why mm-hmm. we keep coming back to this play, because there's something about this deceptively complex and ambiguous play, this play that appears so somehow simple and old-fashioned and, like a sort of New England naive painting that is in fact, that stirs questions in us about what our lives mean, and I think stirs fears in us that we are indeed not capable of realizing life while we live it, and that somehow this precious thing is indeed getting away from us. And I think that that if this play answered that question or reassured us that, in fact, that's all taken care of.
We'd be done with that.
And everything's okay, we would have long since moved on from this play, just as we move on from all kinds of works of art that sort of tie the world and reality up in a neat little bow. And that's not what Wilder does here. And I think that whether you land at the end of this play, horrified and facing a great kind of Beckettian void, as the words of Mr. Stimson ring in your ears, that there's sort of no meaning to anything, or whether you sort of take deep solace in the words of, I believe it's Mrs. Gibbs, I hope Jackson will correct me, you know, who reassures and comforts Emily on her return from her visit back to the land of the living, that it actually, you know, there is meaning in it.
Life is not just a rush gone by and done.
Right. I think that, you know, whatever side of that debate you fall on, you are not offered any kind of closure. And I'm intrigued that this play is being revived by major artists of late, you know, both in the 80s by, I believe it was Robert Falls, with an extraordinary production led by Spalding Gray, and now with Paul Newman on Broadway. I think that we are living in deeply ambiguous, highly uncertain times, and we need to sit with these questions, and I think that's why we hunger for it.
Jackson Breyer, I have to just say again how I felt sort of doubly whacked upside the head by the play, looking back on it again, because if those characters in that bucolic time or setting, at least from our contemporary perspective, felt they had rushed through life, how much more do we rush through life today? Does it, in fact, somehow give it an enhanced wallop for audiences in 2002, when we live on a timetable so much faster and more frenetic, even than the characters in Wilder's play who die and think they've missed it?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, the interesting thing about that passage that you had just before we came back on, you know, Emily says the famous lines, "Do any human beings ever realize life while they live it?" And that's usually read as a kind of positive comment on the value for the smallest events in our lives, which is one of the things Wilder says the play is about. But the line right after that, which I notice either you didn't play or it's omitted from the film, she says, "I'm ready to go back. I should have listened to you. That's all human beings are, just blind people." And that's the moment, as Liz says, where you can really see this as deeply critical, if you want to, of the way we live our lives. And absolutely, today, if anything, we're blinder to those small moments that are important. We're blinder to things like the family existence that Emily treasures when she goes back. Mm-hmm. And absolutely. The other thing, and I don't know whether Liz would agree with this, to some extent, maybe not so much today, but certainly at different times in the history of the contemporary theater, there's been a tremendous emphasis, and certainly this is part of theater, on, you know, scenery and chandeliers and staircases and all the mechanics of theater. And a play like Our Town reduces it down to what makes a play great. And certainly there are lots of other plays like this where it's not about the scenery. It's not about those things. It's about the truths that the play tells. And that's a useful thing to be reminded today, too, because we're a pretty superficial society, too. We tend to value you know, fancy things. And this is a play which strips away all the fancy things.
And perhaps that naked stage makes it very portable through time. Jackson Breyer, Liz Diamond, Jack Beatty, stand by. We're going to come back and hear more and talk more about Thornton Wilder's great stage classic, Our Town, now back again on Broadway with Paul Newman. We'll be right back with much more of that. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Thornton Wilder's great classic stage play, Our Town.
This time, 9 years have gone by, friends. It's the summer of 1913. Gradual changes in Grover's Corners. Horses are getting rarer. Farmers are coming into town now in Fords. Still, you'd be surprised, though, on the whole. Things don't change much around here. This is an important part of Grover's Corners up here in this hilltop. Lots of sky, lots of clouds, often lots of sun, moon, and stars. Certainly a beautiful spot up here.
The stage manager's opening monologue from the third act of Thornton Wilder's Our Town, and that from the soundtrack of a Hollywood version with an Aaron Copland musical score in the background. Jackson Brier, I wonder if the audience felt this a kind of a whiplash, even on this naked stage, when the first act of the play describes what we've all come to see as that kind of Christmas card image of small town life, even with its dryness, even with its sense of irony. There's the daily life that we have learned and been taught to love as a historical icon. And then suddenly we're into death, we're into regret, we're into a very modernist and today, as it's portrayed, maybe postmodernist lament.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the really surprising things about the play. I mean, you know, there you go from actually from the marriage of George and Emily in the second act, and you kind of leave the second act thinking, you know, things are going to end happily. You're going to see their children. You're going to, you know, move into a very...
A bucolic farmhouse,
yeah,
it's picture perfect.
Yeah, a bucolic farmhouse, a happy marriage, and the next thing you know, you're in a graveyard, and time has passed, and the tone of the last act is a completely different tone. I think it's very hard to watch that last act and not see it as a very, very dark picture, somewhat ameliorated by Emily's enthusiasm when she goes back on her birthday, but also...
To see life again, to walk among the living.
Yeah, but, you know, there is the recurrent refrain from the people in that graveyard. They just don't understand, do they, talking about the living.
I guess the question still sticks in my mind about Jackson Brier, about our sense of communion with the dead compared to Thornton Wilder's when he was conceiving and writing this play, when the first audiences saw it. And you think back to the 19th century and seances and the whole Victorian kind of infatuation with death. And even in my own very early childhood, the sense of families visiting graveyards on Memorial Day, sitting among the dead, that seems to me absent from most of contemporary life. And I wonder if we don't perceive that part of the play as a bit from a foreign country.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about that just the other day because I have a friend who died recently, and his wife wrote me recently that she goes to visit the graveyard every so often. And today you just don't hear about that. I mean, most people... if they're buried at all, are buried in some very impersonal place. And I don't think we have that same connection. I mean, I may be wrong. Maybe it's more so in small towns, certainly in urban areas.
I think it's been made antique almost everywhere now.
Well, as I say, I don't have much experience of small town America, but certainly in urban areas, that connection, that feeling that you can go visit a graveyard and leave flowers or throw yourself prostrate on the grave, as George does at the end of Our Town.
And commune somehow with the dead there.
Yeah, and try to... And I think that's what one of the things Wilder's getting at, though, in that last scene, is that you cannot commune. In other words, when the dead keep saying the living don't understand, that's there is a divide there. And maybe Jack Beatty is right that the bridge over that divide is love, but I think Wilder is saying in that last scene that in some ways that bridge cannot be crossed.
Liz Diamond, with The Naked Stage, is this a play that requires updating? Does it take updating in its presentation?
Well, I guess the question you have to ask is, what's a naked stage look like now? or what's naked?
Right.
I was thinking about, you know, the sort of fooling around with categories that you were doing a minute ago, modernist versus postmodernist and stuff. And I was thinking, you know, as you were speaking, Tom, that, you know, I think what makes it impossible for me to see this as a kind of a postmodern piece is simply the fact that it is so sincere in its inquiry.
Yes.
And I think that in a postmodernist hands, these questions would simply be playful. It would be, what the hell? We don't know.
Floating away, and who
we
knows?
We don't know.
Right.
You know? And I think here we're really dealing with, you know, I mean, insofar as form and content, you know, go absolutely hand in glove here, and the form that Wilder was playing with was abstraction, which generally means subtraction, you know, to draw away from etymologically. Is, you know, he's looking to somehow isolate and to essentialize somehow the deep structure of our life as Americans and as families and as human beings, but to somehow find that essence in contemporary American life. Mm. And the only way he can see that will enable us to see it is to strip away away, strip away, strip away, strip away. And we are so saturated with abstraction as a strategy in post-war America, I think it caused some directors to come back and kind of question that and to sort of throw more stuff at it. I don't know. I think you do that with this play at your peril.
There we are. And our time is running out. I wish we could step right onto that stage with each and every one of you and right into this play. But it's been great having you tonight. Liz Diamond, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Liz Diamond is chair of the directing program at the Yale School of Drama and resident director at Yale Repertory Theater. And Jackson Breyer, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you, and happy holidays to Liz and to you.
Same to all. Jackson Breyer is professor of English at the University of Maryland and editor of Conversations with Thornton Wilder. Jack Beatty, last thought on this play?
Well, the current Broadway audience has a surprise. They see shadows behind the curtain arranging furniture, and one of the shadows becomes familiar, and they recognize the shadow of Paul Newman. And that's part of this play, too. It's a very democratic play. We're all equal before the grave.
Yeah, that is for sure. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Most everybody's asleep in Grover's Corners. Oh, there are a few lights on. Down at the depot, Shorty Hawkins has just watched the Albany train go by, and of course out in George and Emily's farm, they're still up, talking over the new baby, I suppose. It's like what one of those Midwestern poets said, you gotta love life to have life, and you gotta have life to love life. O'clock in Grover's Corners. Tomorrow's another day. Everybody's resting in Grover's Corners. You get a good rest, too. Good night.
In a moment, I'll be rejoined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Trent is a valued friend and a man I respect. I'm pleased he will continue to serve our nation in the Senate, and I look forward to working with him on our agenda to make America safer, stronger, and better.
I commend him for his leadership and for his willingness to put the Republican Party's future and his country's future ahead of him. I look forward to being his colleague in the United States Senate. He has a long and useful life there, and I look forward to working with him, and I'm proud of him for his decision.
But our experts have found it to be anything but currently accurate, full, or complete. The Iraqi declaration may use the language of Resolution 1441, but it totally fails to meet the resolution's requirements.
An opportunity was missed in the declaration to give a lot of evidence. And, well, they can still provide it, and I hope they provide it to us orally, but it would have been better if it had been in the declaration.
I will not share in this judgment since we did not receive the whole text. So how to judge the report if it is not complete to be read?
The initial capability, when it's there, would give us a limited capability to deal with a relatively small number of incoming ballistic missiles, which is better than nothing. And it's a start, and these capabilities will evolve over time.
I've decided that I will not be a candidate for president in 2004. My family all gathered here in New York City over the last few days, and I found that I've come to closure on this. I don't think it's the right thing for me to be a candidate.
We have heard many people and many groups come forward with ideas, for how to go forward in addressing the issues. We need to hear what is being said by those who love the church.
A skyscraper rises above its predecessors, reasserting the preeminence of freedom and beauty, restoring the spiritual peak to the city, creating an icon that speaks to our vitality in the face of danger and our optimism in the aftermath of tragedy. Life victorious.
And there's a week Ari Fleischer reads President Bush's reaction to Trent Lott's decision to step down as Senate Majority Leader. Republican colleague Lamar Alexander of Tennessee praises Lott's decision. Secretary of State Colin Powell saying Iraq's arms declaration fails to meet the requirements of the UN Resolution 1441. Chief Weapons Inspector Hans Blix also calls Iraq's declaration a disappointment. Syria's ambassador to the UN boycotts Thursday's Security Council session, complaining that his country had not had access to the full text of Iraq's declaration. President Bush and Donald Rumsfeld announced plans to deploy a limited missile defense shield by 2004. Al Gore says he will not seek the Democratic nomination for president in 2004. The new interim leader of the Boston Archdiocese, Bishop Richard Lennon, calls for healing in his first Sunday sermon since taking over for Cardinal Bernard Law. And seven teams of architects from around the world unveil plans for rebuilding the former World Trade Center site. Four of those plans would include construction of what would be the tallest building in the world. Jack Beatty, a tall tree falls in the U.S. Senate.
Yes, Trent Lott. That's a week of closure for two politicians, Al Gore and Trent Lott. You know, the Southern liberals use the phrase, come over. I came over on the race question, meaning that they changed. Trent Lott never came over. And when you read about his biography, it's sort of clear why. I mean, his psyche was just brined in racism. There was a letter his mother sent to the editor of the local newspaper who'd come out for integration. She sent him a letter pretty much threatening to shoot him. And his uncle was a member of that White Citizens Council who took young Trent to rallies. And even now in his 90s from a nursing home, says, I don't think the races need to mix in this country. They should be apart. This man never came over.
But fascinatingly, in his departure, gives the Republican Party a moment to say, we're done with that.
Yes, the party has never come over either. And I just think, to me, the surprise of this week has been the candor of conservatives, especially commentators, facing up to this strain in their party, not just the segregation strain. Of course, people don't believe in that, but the way the party has, through the 60s and on to today, used the race issue to appeal to bigots, north and south.
Well, you can feel the urge, the need to move beyond that now. And on the Iraq front, it is not war, even though there's a material breach, but that phrase is now out there. It's asserted by the United States, which is, I guess, in Washington's view, the legal justification when and if it comes for war.
Yes, although Colin Powell said, well, don't, you know, that phrase, we don't want to make a fetish out of it, but it is out, right, and it's resonant. And January 27th sort of looms as the next big moment when we're going to hear from Mr. Blix about how inspections have been going, and then next day we're going to have George Bush's State of the Union. The key stumble, you know, the causus belli that looks to be in the future are the families of the scientists. Already, you know, the resolution says they're to be taken out of the country where they can be interviewed. Mr. Blix has seemed reluctant on that, but the Bush administration wants to push it. And that's going to be very tough for Saddam because they won't come back.
They won't come back, and what they say out of the country could be the thing that leads to war.
Yes.
And a great table is set for a new year. Well, Jack, have a great weekend and a great holiday. Thanks for being with us tonight.
And to you and our listeners.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded by